Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, we are so indie this week that I didn't even match the wine. I just brought wine. That's how indie I am.
You're just really going out on a limb here. So what is it?
We're drinking something from Chile. It is a Cabernet Sauvignon from 2015 called Balduzzi.
And we can't think of any way to
I tried. I went through all the... We're going to talk about four movies. I couldn't match it to any of the four.
All right.
And we're so indie this week because neither of us saw American Assassin, weekend's biggest film. And neither of us saw the most talked about film, Mother, lowercase m, exclamation point. So we watched four indies instead because, you know, we all know how our audience loves the indies.
Well, and I got to tell you, though, this morning I felt a little bit of vindication because a friend of mine saw Mother, exclamation point, lowercase m, last night and absolutely hated it.
It's
and
polarizing.
Was so disappointed.
Because there are just as many people who love it.
I know. And so she and her daughter had gone to see it and they both said they were extremely disappointed.
I don't think that's the kind of movie you're supposed to see, like a mother and daughter supposed to go see together. It's like it's not supposed to be a first date movie either.
Well, who's it for? It's for
me.
The obscure you. It's for you and for John Armstrong, maybe. And
he's
maybe
watching that
Christian.
Today, in fact. I think he's watching that right now.
You know, maybe Christian will like it. But my friend Chris Reed just reviewed it. He did not like it. I think he gave it 1 star. So it is very polarizing. And the more I've been able to decipher from the various people I know who have weighed in on it, I don't think I would like it. So now I kind of feel like that's one that I'm not going to go out of my way to catch up on.
Well, I think the four we're going to talk about today are all John Armstrong films and Christian Hammacher films, and certainly four are my films.
Mm-hmm.
I think 2.5 of them are your films. 2.5. I'll give you 2.5.
We'll see.
All right, the first one, I'm going to laugh that I call it the biggest one, is Rebel in the Rye. Rebel in the Rye would make J.D. Salinger turn over in his grave.
Probably.
The most private, reclusive author you could ever name. Never let Catcher in the Rye be filmed while he was alive, and certainly would not want a biopic made about him. So this is based on a biography by a man named Kenneth Slowinski. First-time director, but many-time writer, I believe, Danny Strong. Danny Strong was one of the Mad Men in Mad Men. Mm-hmm. And, all right, I'm not a Catcher in the Rye guy. Everyone read it. I assume everyone has read it. Some people become Holden Caulfield acolytes. They want to wear the deer hunter hat, and they, you know, everyone's a phony. And I enjoyed the novel,
they
but
revel in teenage angst. Well,
did
and
you
alienation.
Did you latch on to Catcher in the Rye when you read it? Did you become a fanatic?
No, I became a fanatic. I remember sort of during that era. I think I was also reading To Kill a Mockingbird and Lord of the Flies, and those are the ones that I actually remember better.
Mockingbird's a much better
absolutely.
Book.
Absolutely, and so.
In the Rye.
I think, and I never knew why Catcher in the Rye, until this movie, I didn't know why Catcher in the Rye was never made into a film. And now, based on this biopic, I now understand that J.D. Salinger refused to sell the theatrical rights to the movie. So I don't know if that would have made a difference, if there had been a film adaptation at the time that I would have seen. But the book itself...
It'd be a terrible movie. You can't make a movie out of that book.
I know, but I kind of feel now that having watched his biopic, I'm a little more intrigued to possibly go back and give Holden Caulfield a second chance. I don't know.
It's not the longest of books. I mean, you could do it. But Rebel in the Rye, nah, it's an okay title. It's catchy if you understand where it's coming from. I kind of liked it. A lot of people are kind of putting this guy, it's like 33% Rotten Tomato on Rotten Tomatoes. I give it a fresh tomato. I kind of liked it. It's the story about how one of the most famous novels from the 20th century came to be. Young J.D. Salinger starts off when he's 20 years old, hanging out in smoky Manhattan jazz clubs, trying to pick up chicks. Then how World War II shaped his thoughts and his personality. And then how he finally ended up writing it, and the world's response to it, and his response to that response. Nicholas Holt is J.D. Salinger. I'm fine with it. Doesn't blow me away. Didn't hurt it. Kevin Spacey is his writing teacher. He actually does the film no favors because he's too good. He's too good. He's so good. He blows everyone else off the screen. He's not chewing scenery either. He's just Kevin Spacey. He's that good. So sorry, Nicholas Hoult. Sorry, Victor Garber. Sorry, Sarah Paulson. You're just not good enough.
But they're all good. That's quite a supporting cast.
Strong.
For Nicholas Hoult to have, you know. And, you know, he's one that we've really only seen in, X-Men.
Well, he was the kid in Mad Max Fury Road. He was Jack and the Beanstalk. That kid.
He's been around, but this is his first sort of moving into adulthood that you really kind of give him his, where he really is the central character, other than that movie that we saw that he was actually quite good in that was Equals with Kristen Stewart.
I dug that movie a lot.
That movie was actually quite intriguing, and he was mesmerizing to watch in that. And so I liked him in this, but I do agree that it's really hard when you have this incredibly strong supporting cast around you to not sort of want to see more of them and more interaction with them. I put it in that so-so indie category. I would maybe give it, you know, I think 33% is kind of low. I would go more to a 50-50 shot. I think anybody who is a J.D. Salinger fan who read Catcher in the Rye and really loved it is going to get some interesting backstory here. So for the literary people among you, then I think those are the ones who might want to seek this one out. I mean, otherwise, it's a decent indie, but it's not breaking any new. It just isn't going to break through, I don't think, to capture people's attention beyond the literary crowd.
So I knew about the man, and I knew he became a recluse in the New Hampshire woods after writing his one novel, and. I knew a lot about it, but I did not know about Zoe Deutsch as Una O'Neill.
Right, yeah.
I knew about Una O'Neill because I saw The Cat's Meow. I knew Una O'Neill, Eugene O'Neill's daughter, the playwright, was 18 years old, married a much older Charlie Chaplin. I did not know J.D. Salinger was macking on her back in the day before he left for war. Says, wait for me, Una. Wait for me. And, you know, Una, 2 weeks later, after he got on the boat, marries Charlie Chaplin.
That was
he was
weird.
Like 46 at the time. Like, something ridiculous.
At least.
And I knew about Una. I did not know about those two. That was a shot. And I love Zoe Deutsch. She's great.
She's not in it for very long, though. This is, she's sort of one of those characters that just kind of pops in and then is suddenly gone. But it informs his choices in life later on, I think, by, you know, his having been burned by her. I think that that kind of was written into the Holden Caulfield character. And he says he's very devoted to Holden as a character, and it's he admits, or at least he says in this movie, we don't really know what he admits to because this movie was sort of what everyone else imagines to have happened.
Yeah, we don't know.
Because we really don't know because he was so so private. But I think he definitely had indicated that this was an autobiographical character. That he was in many ways Holden.
Yeah, there's a lot of him, and it did get creepy when people, I don't know if you want to label them weirdos, but people would show up on his front doorstep saying, "How do you know me? You wrote Holden Caulfield. It's obviously me."
Yeah.
And there are shades of, you know, Mark David Chapman in there. No one, you know, says it. They don't go that far in the future, but gives you the creeps.
Yeah, and if I suspect that if J.D. Salinger were still alive, he died like at 91 or something in 2010, maybe.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's amazing when you think that he really stayed. He managed to stay that reclusive and to really never publish again. He had made this decision to just not publish again because he just didn't like people responding to his craft. He's kind of like he wrote for himself, and so he didn't care what anyone else thought of Catcher in the Rye.
That was a very amusing part they did. It's like, I don't care about reviews. Don't read them reviews.
And then
unless they're good, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
and
oh, okay, like everyone else.
And that's sort of how we feel when we write a review,
I'll read the good
isn't
reviews.
It? It's like, when we're writing, it's like, I don't care what other people think about my reviews because I'm just giving my opinion and I'm writing for myself.
But it's good, right?
But I certainly don't mind when somebody tells me that they liked a particular review or that they care about what my opinion is. So yeah, I get it.
All right. I wonder. I'm going to see if you even remember our next film, because you saw it way back at AFI Docs back in June, and I just saw it this week because I missed it then. But it had its own night. It was so popular, so big during that documentary film festival. It had its own night, like a Friday night, and it was also at Sundance. It was nominated for a documentary. It's called Dolores, about a woman named Dolores Huerta. And the documentary is saying, we should know who she is already. There shouldn't be a documentary about her, because you should already know. But she has been erased, purposefully, maliciously erased from history textbooks and shoved aside. And the documentary tells you it's because she's a woman. And because people didn't agree with her lifestyle choices or whatever. I did not know. I knew Cesar Chavez. Sure. Heard his name? No, he did. I know he founded the United Food Workers.
Or Farmers.
Farmers. No, United.
Is it? Was it? It's the whole Farmers thing.
I thought it was Food Workers. I don't know. No. Field Workers?
Farmers. They organized the farmers.
They organized
in California.
The lowest of the low. The lowest paid people with no political connections, no clout, nothing, and they organized them, and they got power a little bit to get a normal living wage. And it turns out he had a co-founder, and her name was Dolores, and she had 11 children with three different men. And you know what? It's strong. I got a lot out of this documentary. I didn't love it. We moved too fast. She's 87. She's still alive, and there's 87 years worth of stuff in here.
And still doing activism.
And so I wonder, are you with me on this? Are you better than me on this? Did you like it more than me, or maybe you didn't like it as much?
Am I better than you, like, in general? What?
Well, of course you're better than me, Anna.
No, I'm sort of with you. I didn't love it, but I liked it a lot. And what I got out of it was being informed as to who Dolores Huerta was. And like you, I'd certainly heard the name Cesar Chavez. And so to realize that she was an equal, a co-partner, co-founder in this movement, and somehow that got lost. And so this is her moment. I mean, there's a lot of stories coming out about her right now, and she's doing press, and her children are doing some press, and she's still an activist. And so she's sort of now getting her due, and it's many decades overdue. So I remember from the AFI Documentary Festival, the reason that I spoke highly of it and that my colleague Jill spoke highly of it was because it was probably the best profile documentary of the bunch that was done during that documentary festival. So it wasn't one of the best documentaries overall, but in terms of profiles, they found really good. It was amazing. They had found all this footage. And when you talk about how she was sort of, her story was kind of buried, this footage existed because there was supposed to be a segment on like a TV news magazine show about her. And it turned into one of those very brief segments that they didn't use a lot of the stuff that they had shot. And so the director had found all this footage and had done some digging. And it was like, wow, there's this treasure trove of footage that existed where you actually see her standing next to Cesar Chavez and on the front lines rallying for civil rights and labor and labor rights. And so it's kind of fascinating that her story did take this long to suddenly come out and be in the spotlight. How she had, I can understand to some degree, I mean, even I was sort of taken aback by the fact that you're like, when and how in the world did she have 11 children in the midst of this?
She couldn't have had time to do that.
I don't know how she had time. I'm guessing that she was maybe Catholic and did not believe in birth control. I do not know, but all I know is that it was very obvious. There was a Q&A after the screening I attended with the director and with one of her children. And the children aren't really, or at least some of them, the ones that we saw, were not really bitter about the fact that they were placed second to the organizational efforts. And she sort of left it to others to help raise them. And miraculously, they've turned out pretty well, and they've turned out to be in service to society for the most part themselves. So good on her for that. But my goodness, she made some harsh choices, and I'm not so sure that I'd be as forgiving. It seems like a pretty rough way to just keep having kids and then sort of leave them be and go off and try and make a difference for millions of other people, whereas you've got these 11 kids sort of scattered back at home, one of whom is a Chavez, which was really confusing because you realize she had a kid with Cesar Chavez's brother. And so that added to a little bit of the confusion as to who all these kids are and where and when they came from. Because you never really see her pregnant much in this film.
No, not at all. The director, Peter Bratt, and if you recognize his last name, it's because his brother's name is Benjamin. And it was executive produced, and the idea came from one Mr. Carlos Santana. He called up Peter Bratt one day. He's like, hey, how is there no documentary about Dolores Huerta? Get on it. I'm choosing you. You go out and do this now. And he wasn't even a documentary filmmaker. He was a filmmaker. He makes regular films. Like, I don't know how to make a documentary. So he interviewed 10 of the 11 kids, and it's warts and all. Some of them have, you know, emotional scars here. Like, you know what? She left me in Bakersfield. And for 4 years, I was pissed. And when she came back to get me, I didn't want to go. So they don't whitewash this. They don't cover it up. She's like, yeah, probably shouldn't have left my kid behind, but I had to go to New York and boycott grapes.
Yeah.
And there's good – they have some really strong talking heads here. There's footage of her standing right next to Bobby Kennedy when he wins California primary. There's footage of her with Gloria Steinem in New York. They got Angela Davis here talking about her. But don't believe the trailer. The trailer has back-to-back Hillary Clinton saying a glowing sentence and Nancy Pelosi saying a glowing sentence. But that's all there is. You think it's alluding to, ooh, there's a much longer interview in there. There's not. Yeah. They have one sentence, and it's in the trailer. It's barely in the movie, and then it's no more. They're just doing that to, like, ooh, look, powerful people are talking about Dolores. But it's not in the movie.
And it doesn't really portray the movie accurately. One of the most fascinating parts for me was the whole Bobby Kennedy thing. I forgot about that she was there the night of the assassination. I mean, it was just fascinating stuff that was built into that documentary. So while it wasn't a great documentary, it's still a fascinating story.
Yeah, it's in the middle of the road for me. There's a lot more documentaries I like better than this one, but I'm glad I just learned who she was. Good.
I think you like the next documentary we're going to talk about a little better.
Next, I shouldn't though, because this next documentary, it's so odd that you could make a documentary about a school year, a year in the life of school kids, 12-year-olds in Ireland. It's called School Life. Very recently, it was called In Loco Parentis. In fact, it was In Loco Parentis at Sundance, where it was also nominated for a documentary award. But now, I guess, to not scare away American audiences with a Latin title, it's called School Life, and it's by her name's in Gaelic. So her name is Niasa Ní Chéanáin and David Rain.
Yeah, I was like not even going to attempt that one.
I really enjoyed it. I had a smile on my face watching this. It's not really about the kids. It's about two teachers, married couple, John and Amanda Layden. They've been teaching at this school, the same school, for 46 years. And they're just having a blast. They can't retire because what would they do? You know, they need their kids. And they teach everything. Like, he teaches math, Latin, and rock band. And she teaches literature. And it's a year in the life of these school kids. And it's awesome. It's not the best. I'm not giving it 4 stars here. But it's so good. I really enjoy just sitting back and watching these kids.
I called it charmingly boring. So I had no idea. The first 10 minutes, I was really confused. I'm like, I had to go back and look at whether this was a documentary or a drama. I was not clear on that from the opening scenes because it felt scripted to me. And I'll tell you, that guy John, the teacher, straight out of Central Casting. He really was.
<hair.
laughs> He's like dry, sarcastic.
His sense of humor is phenomenal.
It is. It is very funny. It takes some. It's one of those ones that you just have to give it time to get into. My fear is that it's difficult to give it that time because the first half took me quite a while to get through, to figure out what it was trying to be. You know, it was like, is this the Hogwarts of Ireland? And it kind of is. And these are pretty privileged kids who are at this boarding school, and it's this 18th century estate that they're spending their school year in. And it's only in the second half where you really start identifying a couple of the kids and tracking them a little bit. There's this kid, Teddy, who's just awesome. I love Teddy. And Amanda, like the teacher, loved Teddy. Did you not love Teddy?
Ted got on my nerves a little
You
bit.
Probably liked Eliza, the like.
Loved girl. Eliza. Actually, I liked Eliza was great, but she's not my favorite. My favorite was the little drummer girl.
The little drummer girl.
The drums
girl,
were
the
playing
model.
Her. No, not Flory.
Wasn't she?
The first drummer.
The first drummer girl.
Her name's like Becky or something.
But yeah, but there was this kid, Teddy, who was obviously the sort of teacher's pet of Amanda, is that her name? The wife, and then you had Eliza, who needed to come out of her shell, and she was sort of the favorite of.
She's John's project.
She is John's project. He wants to see her break out of this sort of drab shell. She won't smile. She won't engage very much, even though he can tell that she's extremely bright, and so. You're kind of watching as the school year comes to a close to see what happens with these particular kids. And it's, I'd say, at first I thought it was going to be like School of Rock, but I was like, no, that's not where this is going. These kids aren't actually all that great. I mean, some of their band numbers in the band are entertaining to watch, but they're not like this. They're not going to go on to the regionals and compete in Glee for band attention. But it was sweet, and I did. If nothing else, it's an homage to those few teachers that you have over the years that truly make a real impression on you and tried their hardest to make learning fun.
These kids will remember John and Amanda for the rest of their lives.
Yeah,
the access the cameras got. It's phenomenal. The kids didn't even see the camera. Not once does a kid actually just look into the camera. Probably after 2 days of filming, they just forgot it was there because that camera's everywhere. And it goes into the staff meetings. So you get to hear what the teachers are saying about what kids are doing great and what kids need work. So I'm sure the kids would be fascinated about that. And so it's like it's got one leg in tradition. You know, they're wearing uniforms or at this. It's the only primary boarding school in Ireland. So there's only one. And yes, their parents are obviously financially successful. And these kids will be the next, you know, prime minister of whatever country they're from. And they're from like 18 different countries. Like one's going to Eton, one of them's going to Harrow, that sort of thing. But it also has one leg in modernity, like that rock band. And if you don't want to play in the band, you can just sit and paint or do woodworking. And, you know, there's cell phones. So it's just fun.
Everyone would love to go to this school. I mean, to have those teachers. I had one of those teachers, and in loco parentis actually means in place of parents. And so the idea is that you've got these administrators and the teachers at this particular school who, for the duration of the school year, really are taking on that role, and they are in place of the parents during those months. And it gets very emotional at the end because the school year's coming to a close. And it was like watching kids at camp. And it's like, oh my gosh, you know, we've been together for a month or 2 months, and now we have to go our separate ways, and everybody's teary. And you realize that these kids, they all want to, you know, see each other again and sign each other's yearbooks. And it's very sweet in that approach. I did feel like I was watching a bunch of kids leaving camp at the end of summer, waiting, just, you know, who can't wait to come back and see each other again the next year. But I don't know. It absolutely grew on me, but it took until the second half to really get engrossed in the kids themselves and their stories.
All right, I think I liked it a little bit better than you did.
A little bit, but it definitely grew on me, and I would give a shout-out to my Latin teacher from high school, Mr. Rifkin, who was exactly that kind of teacher who looked, you know, went outside of the traditional teachings and was the advisor for Quiz Bowl and took us to Carmen to see the opera and had an Italian dinner at his house, and I'm pretty sure there was a glass of wine involved. And it is really important that you have those teachers at that level who are going to really help steer you and think outside the box and just be those great teachers that go beyond the call of duty and really care about the kids.
Well, I'm pretty sure I liked our next film. I'm just going to say a little bit more than you did, I can't believe you watched this film. I can't believe you watched it. It's a South Korean film called The Villainous. In South Korean, it's called Akneo. It was at Cannes. It was invited to the Cannes Film Festival
this
year. And it is so violent. The director is a man named Jung Byung-gil.
Uh-huh. What was that?
Jung Byung-gil.
Okay.
And it's... South Koreans know and love their revenge movies. Old Boy, Sympathy for Lady Vengeance. I've seen quite a few. Like, I lived in Korea for a year. I've seen a lot of Korean movies. And I like South Korean cinema. And so the villainess is right up my alley. And half of it is freaking amazing. It's across... The first 7 minutes of this film are half Old Boy and half Hardcore Henry. It's first-person shooter. All you see is a gun and then butcher knives. And it's this one lady. Well, you don't even know him until later. It's a lady. Yeah. Clearing. It's like The Rage. She's clearing this house, this gang house, floor by floor, of just nonstop ass kickery. And, oh my, I was like, is this going to be 2 hours of this? Settle in and get the popcorn, folks. No, it's not 2 hours of that. It slows way down and it becomes this emotional, melodramatic roller coaster.
And then it goes back.
It makes some terrible choices. But then they hop back on a motorcycle and fight with swords on a motorcycle. And then later on, she hops on a bus and does just unspeakable things to the people in that bus. So half of this movie was terrific. Some of the best violent action of the year. And the other half
was the part I liked.
So bad, I'm actually giving this a down vote.
Well, I finished watching it for the sole purpose of telling you that I finished watching it. Mm. The first 3 minutes, I went, I'm going to kill Charlie. 5 minutes later, I was like, why am I watching this? 30 minutes later, I go, okay, I give up. I stopped it. The next day, I was like, I can't let Charlie get away with telling me, I can't believe you didn't watch this all the way through. So I went back and I finished watching it. It's 2 hours and change, by the way.
Yeah, a little bit.
So it's like, come on, of this very bizarre movie that's very hard to follow. Everyone looked exactly the same. I couldn't tell. Oh my God, I couldn't tell who was who. But
But it's confusing. I'll give it to you. It's a confusing plot.
It's very confusing. And the irony is that I went home and I watched this one as a screening link because I was too tired to go to the theater to watch American Assassin.
Shame on you.
So I was like, okay, so instead of American Assassin, I now have Bloody Korean Assassin.
I haven't seen American Assassin, but this has to be so much more violent.
This
than
is more violent than Atomic Blonde.
Yeah,
so basically,
absolutely.
If you make Atomic Blonde into a Korean movie, that's essentially, I think, a kind of what you get here, to the nth degree. The part that you didn't like, that to me was the relief.
The way too much violence inflicted on a toddler.
Oh my gosh!
Oh my God!
Don't even go there.
That's what I didn't like.
When you have a cute kid and you're just finally like, oh, at least there's a cute kid in this film. I was feeling some relief, but you can't feel relief for very long.
Good Lord!
But there's this sort of romance, you know, built in, but you don't know if the romance is real, if the villainess herself is being played, if she's playing all those around her. I don't know. I mean, the whole idea is, I mean, to give people a general overview, it's about this woman. So she comes out of this.
So Ki
comes out of this house where she's like killed a gazillion different guys for whatever reason.
Oh, you find out later.
Completely unclear. Even later, I'm still not quite clear. And you think she's going to be arrested, but instead she's sort of taken to some black ops facility and told, okay, here's the deal. We're going to train you to be an assassin to work for us. And you give us the next 10 years of your life. And then we'll give you a pension and your freedom.
Yeah, because that's a big theme in the film is live a normal life.
Yeah.
Everyone just wants to live a normal life.
Yeah, and so they're like, we're going to give you this chance to live a normal life in 10 years, or we'll kill you now. What would you prefer?
She's a sleeper cell.
And she's a sleeper cell, but then they tell her, oh, by the way, you're pregnant. So if you kill yourself, you're also killing your kid.
Yeah, that's a thing.
And so that's really what informs her choice at that point to take this devil's bargain. And then this film just kind of goes on to kind of track what happens to her after she's made this choice. And I don't know. From that point on, I couldn't tell. Did she have some plastic surgery at some point?
Yeah, they changed her face, which is, again, reason A why it's complicated. There's a lot of flashbacks to when she's a girl, then to when she's a young lady. I understand. It's very complicated.
Yeah.
And what didn't help it is that jarring shift in tone from slaughter to domestic romance.
Yeah, that's right.
That just didn't help anybody.
It didn't help anybody. It helped me a little bit because it gave me some breathing room. And you kind of root for this romance in the middle there, even though you kind of suspect it might be doomed. Because nothing seems to end very well for this poor woman. But the violence, the blood splatter is so overt
constant. The story is so ridiculous. Judged by any measure, the story is ridiculous. But when they get into the action scenes, just hook up the IV hand, hook up the IV right into my arm and give me, you know, something alcoholic. Because I'm invested. It's so good.
And that's when I was out. That's when I tuned out and I waited for the nice little romantic beat that sort of appeared very briefly.
And then you can go inflict more violence on a
toddler. Even with the romance, that was another, I'm like, is that the guy who had the hots for her, who was watching her on the closed circuit television? I'm like, I'm not really sure, because everybody was then made to look slightly different, and the flashbacks, I couldn't remember. I'm like, is that, I know that's supposed to be her, but it doesn't look like her. So I don't know. This is absolutely for you.
It's a genre film.
It's a genre film. And if you like intense blood splatter, action, vengeance, if you want a Korean.
If you like Sympathy for Lady Vengeance.
And I've never seen any of them.
If you liked Hong Kong kung fu films, Yusha films.
Yeah.
Then this is your film.
And it's not me.
No, if you like Steel Magnolias and Home Again, The Villainess is not for you.
I'm somewhere in between. Come on, I'm expanding. Aren't you proud that I'm expanding my horizons, that I actually sat through 2 hours and 2 minutes?
I'm more than surprised. I'm
horrifying,
utterly shocked.
Film.
I can't believe you watched this movie.
Thank goodness Artie Chick for chickflix.net wrote the review.
Did she like it?
On our behalf. And she did like it for what, as you, for what it was, as that genre film, and agreed that it is only for people who are already fans of that genre. If you're not a fan of that genre, just skip it.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
Same with anything starring Reese Witherspoon.
No.
I don't like that garbage.
No.
Skip it.
Yeah. Oh, come on. Really, I can't wait to see what the box office returns are on Home Again versus...
You know what?
Villainous.
The gutter evil clown murdered Reese Witherspoon at the box office.
That reminds me, because at the end of this film, and I don't think I'm spoiling it for too many people, because I really don't think anyone's going to see the villainess other than you. She has this grin at the end that all I could think of is it reminded me of the Pennywise grin in It. She smiles at the camera, and it's this evil grin.
I hope there's a villainess too.
And it did. It was like, I was like, please don't let this be the start of a Jason Bourne franchise, because it's almost that style of story.
Jason Bourne would have his hands full.
Jason Bourne would be the way more mainstream version of the villainess. And again, Atomic Blonde would be sort of on par, I think, with this type of character. But boy, yeah, no. Most people would not make it past the 3-minute mark of this movie.
I'm just shocked you watched.
I'm just All glad right. you brought the wine.
That takes that completes our indie version of the weekly films. If it's showing at your local multiplex, we probably didn't talk about it.
But you know what? That might be okay, because I don't think there's anything new showing. I don't think American Assassin or Mother are necessarily going to be any better than these indies that we just talked about.
Well, I don't know. I haven't seen them. But Rebel in the Rye, I think we liked it better than the average critic. I have no personal connection to that novel or Salinger, so I don't care if Salinger's offended.
Yeah. If you're a fan of the book, then I think you'll get something out of this movie. But most people aren't going to care one way or another.
The documentary Dolores is more necessary than enjoyable.
Yes, I agree. And you'll read a lot, currently about Dolores Huerta, and you'll see her. And so now it is good to have some context for why she's suddenly in the news, and the fact that she's 87 and still fighting for, the average Joe.
My favorite film of the week was School Life, a documentary from Ireland. taking place in an 18th century house, starring teachers I wish I had.
I like that. That's a good analogy. I had a hard time with the first half. I felt it was a little contrived. I feel like there was a little bit of editing going on that was structured in such a way that it made me a little suspicious that that they didn't know the cameras were there or that nothing was necessarily recreated. But the second half, and once you know some of these kids, again, charmingly boring.
The villainous, blood does not ooze, blood does not drip. Blood volcanoes like a geyser.
And what's not to love about that on your weekend? Come on.
Make sure to watch it with your family over Thanksgiving.
That's right.
All right. On behalf of the Cinema Clash, I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.